Hello everyone, my name is Michael Coveney and I'm responsible, so throw stones later for the book. But really you're all responsible because there's so many people here who fed into this book, not to mention our distinguished panellists. So I'd like to introduce you to, and would you welcome, Daisy Campbell. Nina Conti. Sorry, I've forgotten your name. Jim Broadbent. And Richard Eyre. There is a bizarre reason for being in this theatre for this book, which is that Ken Campbell, I think, partly became Ken Campbell because he was rejected here in the first place. He was in contact with Lindsay Anderson, who he met on a train, and Lindsay Anderson, who was a director here, said to him, I think you should write a Brechtian play. So Ken sent him his Jack Shepherd pirate, his highwayman play, which he'd written for Stoke and Bolton, and said, is that the sort of thing you mean? To which Lindsay Anderson said, no. But he liked the cut of his jib, and he liked the fact that he wasn't like all the other people hanging around the Royal Court at the time. So at that moment, then Lindsay Anderson gave him a play to do, written by Frank Norman, called Inside Out. It was a prison play. It was on this stage with Bill Owen in it, but it was an unhappy experience, and he was sort of relieved of his duties, and Lindsay Anderson took over. And something that made a big impression on Ken Campbell, I think, was that Lindsay didn't remove his name for the credits. He kept it on kept his name on it, did the production himself. So Ken went away with his tail between his legs and thought, what am I going to do now? And ended up having done previous in Stoke and Bolton with The Roadshow, which he launched. And within a year, amazingly, he was back in this theatre, in the theatre upstairs, as part of the Come Together Festival with Jane and David and Sylvester McCoy. No, not Sylvester McCoy, he came later. And that's another story.
He always comes later.
Yeah. I'm just checking we were here, actually. He was the man who was stupid enough to do what Ken Campbell told him to. Anyway, so they were back here in the Come Together Festival, 1970. Ken Campbell Roadshow became a fixture in the theatre upstairs. And then, of course, a great caper on this very stage, The Search for the Perfect Woman. And this was before Prue came along, of course. It was a wonderful play, rather static play, full of wonderful speeches, described by Ronald Bryden, who was the great Ken Campbell critic, I think, as the alternative Around the World in 30 Days, in which Ken played Passepartout to the Phileas Fogg of Warren Mitchell, who, as you all know, was his great mentor and discoverer. When Ken understudied him in the West End play called Everybody Loves Opal, it turned out nobody loved Opal, and it closed, but then Warren Mitchell directed his first play in 1964. So there's a wonderful connection here. The great caper broke all box office records for the lowest attendance in this. 20% only exceeded, I think, a few years later by a Robert Holman play. Equally good, I have to say.
Which I was in.
Were you really? I'll just change what I was going to say. Ken, of course, came back here with Theatre Stories in 96, and at the centenary, at the 50th anniversary, did Decor Without Productions with his improv crowd in the theatre here. It was called Decor Without Productions, because there used to be Sunday night productions without decor, and so he was just turning the whole thing on his head. I'd like to thank Nick Hearn and all his team for producing such a wonderful book, and I know there's so many of you here who whose lives were changed by Ken Campbell. Before I get on to the panellists, I'd just like to say one thing that for me characterises the theatre of Ken Campbell, which was in opposition to what everyone else was doing. Before The Roadshow, he was in a production of Macbeth at Stoke, in which the actor and director Ron Daniels was playing the lead. Ron Daniels, he said, who went on to have an extinguished career with the RSC. Hello, Rob. Yes. Ken, of course, was playing the porter and getting huge laughs, and the porter scene went on forever. And Ron was giving an important performance, was not best pleased. He used to appear earlier than he should in the subsequent scene of the porter scene. And, in fact, was on there forever. And Ken was doing his bit. Sir John Sessions, who was just... Gate crash proceedings, I see. Anyway, well, thank you for ruining my story. But you all know it anyway. But what happened was that he was doing the porter scene, and it was getting huge laughs, and Ron came on, fed up with this. At the end of the scene, Kaith Ness and Menteith came on, and they have to say, is thy master stirring? And Ken said, yes. Because Ron had been on for ages. He said, there he is, he's stirring you right in the face. I have a special relationship with this play. But I'd like to ask Richard, I mean, everyone here had their lives changed, not least Daisy, by the fact that Kane Powell was in the world. I've asked about Richard, perhaps historically, you encountered him first. Do you remember the first time you ever sort of bumped into Ken and how he then ruined your life?
I bumped into him here because I came to the Come Together Festival, which was a festival of experimental theatre, fringe theatre, stuff that couldn't get on anywhere. A lot of really interesting stuff, I guess, would be under the umbrella of happenings. And I saw the Roadshow here, not with Sylvester. And then I was then working in Edinburgh and invited the company, the Roadshow. I did a festival, which was a sort of mimicry of the festival that had gone on here, and invited the Roadshow to come to the theatre upstairs in the Lyceum Theatre in Edinburgh, which I'd opened for the occasion. And in fact, Ken opened the theatre. The Roadshow opened the theatre, and Dave Hill and Jane were in the Roadshow at the time. And I got to know Ken then, and asked him when, shortly afterwards, I became director of Notting Playhouse. And it was at a time, this was early 70s, when it was thought incumbent on somebody who's running a regional theatre to do regional work. So if you were in Sheffield, you had to do plays about knife grinders. And if you were in Nottingham, you had to do plays about lace workers. And so I discovered this story about a prize fighter called Bendigo, who had been born in Nottingham. And I invited Ken to write the story of Bendigo, which was called Bendigo, the Little Known Facts. entirely invented facts. And he recruited his friend Dave Hill and musician Andy Andrews. And it was a musical, and we did two of these musicals. The excellent Ronald Bryden, you referred to, said, if there's a future, when he saw one of these musicals, said, if there's a future to the British theatre, then it lies here. On the other hand, there was another critic who said, if there's anyone in the world who likes this show, I can't imagine what they would be like. And he said, on the night that I was there, only the friends of the writers seemed to be enjoying it. Rich Kent, friends of the writers? Well, I am the writer! he was very, very indignant about it. So, Ken enhanced my life in every way. Even ringing me up, there was a period where he'd ring me up at 3 a.m. to share with me his latest enthusiasm. The only thing theatrically, everything about Ken, that about daring, about imagination, about not accepting the status quo, about subverting the orthodox, everything about Ken in the theatre, I thought was absolutely wonderful. And I always felt in Ken's presence insufficiently adventurous, always in some way disappointing Ken, as most of us who worked with Ken felt, because we would never go the final mile. But the last time I actually worked with Ken was Secret Policeman's Ball a few years ago. Ken was asked to contribute something and asked me if I would stage a sketch from the show, that one of the shows we'd done in Nottingham, and it was a sketch, Renaissance Man sketch, about a man trying to break through the warp and weft of time and pang himself to other worlds. Were the thread of marching time elastic, could I but pang myself to other worlds? And in order to do this, he had to set up time present on one side, time going slowly on one side, and time going fast on the other side of the stage. Time going slowly was his wife hitting him over the head. Then he'd run across the stage, and there were wenches and feeding him with wine and cheese. And he'd run between the two to try and break through the warp and weft of time. And anyway, this marvellous sketch, and Ken said it would be better if there were six pigs in it. Five pigs. And this was a very, very useful theatre lesson, because I'm directing a show which has a pig in it. And the first one I was asked to do it, I said, if the pig's alive, then I'm out of it. And it was complete disaster. But I don't think I've ever seen Ken so happy as that.
We have to ask Jim, because there is a pig connection here. You were involved, I think, you weren't cast originally by Ken as a pig handler, but you found him. Did he save you from being a West End understudy or star of some kind?
Understudy. I was understudying in the bed before yesterday at the Ben Travers farce when I. I first saw Ken here at the theatre upstairs with the Come Together season, which is, and it was with Dave and Jane and Bob, and that was brilliant. And it took me about 4 years before I plucked up the courage and to actually approach him and say, did he have anything for me? And that was when he was about to do Illuminatus, which is, it was a fantastic, I mean, and come and join the most remarkable play yet done on planet world. it was just so exciting to meet him. And immediately the enthusiasm and the relish of theatre was so infectious, and so, it got instantly straight into your bloodstream. That's why we all tried to impersonate him, I think. Everyone was impersonating him, because you think if you impersonate him well enough, you might sort of become him. Get his enthusiasm and understand it, and all that real excitement. And I, when we were on Illuminatus, said to Chris Fairbank, like, 2 weeks in, I said, do you realise that from now on our life is either before Illuminatus or after Illuminatus? And that was 1976, and it's still the case. And still, that was a completely life-changing experience. And, as Richard said, you sort of disappoint him because you can't go the last mile. But the thing is, we all tried very hard to... I mean, we're all incredibly biddable. Because, you know, the chances are it was worth it. So you do extraordinary, being asked to do extraordinary things, and you'd do it. I mean, and there's the example, I told the story at Ken's funeral, but for those of you who weren't there, when we were doing Illuminatus in Amsterdam, and we all we're all in a lift in the hotel, a very modern hotel, and about seven or eight of us in this lift going down to the ground floor. And Ken said, everyone on the floor and get the most amazing contorted positions you can think of. So we all did. Instantly, eight of us biddable, including me. And the lift doors open and there were loads of people in the foyer. And they said, that came down at a hell of a lick. Sums up how absolute joy of performance.
Is it, is it to do with him as a director, or is it his personality? How do these two things merge, do you think? That he makes you do these things, and he's leading you on some strange and ridiculous journey? Or is it because he's a great theatre director? Is it because he's Ken Campbell? Is there an answer to that? That's a lot of stupid
questions. It's the question we all try to answer, Michael, actually, with Ken. And as Jim says, you know, you have this feeling that you must go the extra mile into the stratosphere of Kendom, which is, you know, he was very inspirational, didn't he? He just made you want to go to that next peak, you know.
Well, he sorted you out a bit, didn't he? What happened to you?
I don't know. Well, one day, what he did, I auditioned for him in his front room with Daisy's toys all over the floor. Because Daisy was very small at the time. And I did Ian McKellen flying the Flying Eye, you know, the traffic helicopter. And I did Mike Lee as a Chinese takeaway owner. Ken said, I think you need to come up to Liverpool, but to give you an equity card, I want you to do a show every night that's completely different. If it is completely different, I'm not going to fucking pay you. Ken's directorial notes were amazing. There was an actress, a girl called, I've not seen her since, Victoria Plum. And Victoria had quite a big nose. And one day Ken was going, "I don't understand you, Victoria. You've got this fucking great hooter. You should be waving around with pride. Get on, pick up some Kenneth Williams nostril acting. And then one day he goes, "I've been looking in the paper today. There's a lot of very miserable women down at Greenham Common. I think you need to go down and entertain them." So we drove down there, all the way from Liverpool, where we were doing my one-man show and this sequel to The Warp, which I was found so embarrassing. I was one of the leads, and I used to try and get out of the light. They called Chameleon Blue. Anyway, we drove around at Greenham Common, and indeed, it was a lowering, miserable February afternoon, and all these women all looking like bulldogs chewing wasps. He goes, "Hello, ladies. He's called John Sessions. He's come all the way from Liverpool to entertain you. So laugh away." So I tried to do a little show, and I took complete silence. "Hey, John Sessions, wasn't he good?" "Ta-ra, ta-ra."
Moving along, we have to go. skipping so much, really. But Nina, you had a strange encounter with Ken. Almost by accident, did you bump into him in the Hampstead High Street?
Yeah, I'd seen his shows and loved them, and I just ran up to his car as he was at the traffic light and said, "I like you, I think you're amazing." He said, "I like you too." So yeah, that was how we met. And then I found him at the Warp, where I knew Alan Cox and knew that he was doing the Warp again, so I just turned up. And well, I thought, once I found these guys, I'm not going anywhere else. It was just so exciting. But then, and then I stuck around him for a long time and did the Pigeon Macbeth, and then it all went tits up, and I walked out of that show at the National. And I thought that was it. I thought I'd bollocked it up forever. But then he sent me a Teach Yourself Ventriloquism kit.
But you joined the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Yeah, I joined the Royal Shakespeare Company, so he got into sort of, you know, boring stuff. And then I was having a struggle with the voice department there. They didn't like my voice. They said, Sis Berry, famous voice coach, said, you've got to make your voice one that I can listen to. I told that to Ken, and he said, oh, if you want to know about voice, you should become a ventriloquist, and I'll send you some kit, but you've got to promise that you will work at it. And he did his bidding. I was desperate to get out one of his puppets, because he actually left me his puppets in his will, and this is a fabulous one here. Oh, well, this is exciting, the royal court. So now this is my life. Yes, here you are, dear, still there. Sitting there trying not to move your mouth. Doing Ken's bidding.
Yes.
Still at this time. How are you, dear?
Was she your Scottish granny?
I was Gertrude Stein, the American novelist from Ken. With Nina, she's made me her own grandmother. Comfort, yes. The comfort, I find you comforting. And she keeps me in a hold-all. I was at the National with Ken, and now I'm in a hold-all. Comedy circuit. My whole life, you know, I now owe to Ken completely, because he set me on such an exciting, quirky path I would never have discovered. She didn't even like ventriloquism. No, still don't. That's not true, do you know? Everything, and then, you know, I'm now doing this job. I remember once saying to him, I was scared he was going to try and ruin my career, because I pissed him off. But that was before I became a ventriloquist. He gave me a career. You know, everything. It's all thanks to Ken. You too, dear, yes. Yeah. You know, where would you do?
You know the one, everybody knows the Royal Dickens. Have you spoken about that, Michael? Royal Dickens Company?
The Hoax, yes.
You know the Royal Dickens Company?
Yes.
Oh. My favourite part of it was the letter he wrote to Lindsay Anderson. How'd you in mind for the Owl Curiosity Show? Can't think why.
That was very interesting, because there was the huge success of Nicholas Nickleby, and it was he'd done The Walk just the year before, and so his epic was had been acclaimed in certain quarters, but not on the scale necessarily of the Nicholas Nickleby, and so his way of appreciating Nicholas Nickleby was to engender this great hoax. So it was a brilliantly executed hoax in which they got hold of some. The Royal Shakespeare Company notepaper and reconfigured it, redesigned it with a brilliant graphic designer called Richard Adams, who I think is here tonight. And they sent out the letters offering these jobs. And after several weeks of this, Trevor Nunn said that it's become really embarrassing with people turning down the offers of work, but even more embarrassing, accepting. What was it going to be? Bleak House, directed by, or rewritten by Snoo Wilson, was going to be the first one. I think, Richard, you had
it. I was rather flattered. I got our mutual friend.
Did you know it was a hoax or...?
Well, I thought it was a brilliant mimicry of the literary style of Trevor Nunn. And it ended, yours ever, Trevor. Which was wholly, unerringly accurate. But there were a number of people I knew who were very flattered to be asked, who had never been invited to direct Shakespeare.
Daisy. Mm. Now, tell us, how is it that you grow up with Ken and then you become a director and you want to work... how do you escape from him? How do you follow him? How does he control your life? What happened with you and him?
I'm still, you know, a lot of people, anyone who's been involved with a Ken Campbell production will say that everything after it is a little bit dull. Just And I feel like my whole life was a Ken Campbell production.
What was the first thing? What did he get you to do, first of all?
What did he get me to do? Well, I mean, he was always getting me to do things like... I had to learn speeches if I wanted new pairs of shoes, if I wanted new training trainers. I still believe I'm the fastest at the to be or not to be speech. I think I'm the record holder with that. And he got me involved with everything. But I mean, my childhood with him was completely magical. And we had a boat on the River Lee that we'd go off on jaunts. He got the strongest magnet in the world from a fishing shop, and we used to go fishing in the River Lee for sort of supermarket trolleys and ovens. And the gongoozlers, as he called them, oh, look, there's some gongoozlers there, let's go and show him our magnet. And we'd spend happy afternoons gongoozling the River Lee with our magnet and our boat. And we were always putting on films with my friends, you know, making films and this kind of thing. So it was magical. And, you know, if he had to sort of tell me off or point something out, he'd find the most creative way he could to do it. I remember coming back from boarding school and back to my room, and I'd obviously left for about 3 months an old plate of food and a glass of milk and a, you know, thing. And he'd lined them all up beautifully on this shelf and printed out and typed up little placards that said, experiment one. Experiment two, the glass of milk, because they were in a mouldy room. Always things like this. And so it was completely magical. And then I remember we kind of fell out for a while. He was very overbearing, and we fell out for a while. But I remember saying to my great friend Madeline, I remember saying, if I was to meet someone as utterly brilliant and inspiring as my dad, and he wasn't my dad, then I'd just say to him, teach me everything you know, please. So why am I not doing that? Just because he's my dad. So I remember, I think I wrote him a letter. We were literally not on talking terms at the time. And I wrote him a letter and sent it to him, sort of proposing that I do a kind of apprenticeship with him. And I got back a fax to my mum's place where I was staying saying, the Tilly Matthews Academy of Bizarre and Adventurous Education accepts your offer. And that was it. And then I was doing, you know, I had to go and do Punch and Judy courses 1 week, or then I was off, I had to become an NLP practitioner, which then entitled me to be Miss Eris Trance Inducer for the Warp Revival. And so he would write prescriptions for the actors, saying, you have more confidence, better line learning ability. And they'd sort of come sheepishly up to Miss Eris, the trance inducer. No one knew I was his daughter. And sit down, and I would sort of induct them into this kind of more confidence. And that was a real irony, the whole way that he brought that Warp Revival together, that, you know, he was based... I was watching, because it was the first epic I'd sort of seen him attempt to pull together, and I would have been about 17 or something. And all these people turned up, these fresh-faced people, and he was going to be asking them to do a 24-hour play with no money involved, and, you know, this, that. And I thought, well, he was going to have to be really nice to them and all that. And he did cook them a bit of grub, I think. But the first thing he did was made everyone learn an incredibly difficult speech from AC/DC. So everyone was all learning these things. And then he just shouted and abused everyone and made everyone feel utterly shit and crap about themselves. And, of course, when he held the next meeting, most of the people who'd been at that first meeting hadn't come back, but only the hardcore and the unhinged remained, and no real ones that he wanted to kind of carve out. Yeah.
Did you first saw him perform in the Furtive Nudist?
Yeah.
So that's 1988. When you saw him on the stage doing the monologue, which incorporates a lot of autobiography, a lot of his life, sort of skewed through storytelling and narrative, did you recognise him? Was he a different person?
Exactly the same.
Oh,
exactly the same person. And he would be constantly trying things, you know, at home, but you wouldn't know he was trying them. He was just telling you great stories. I mean, you know, you turn up... This thing about is it Ken Campbell or is he the great director? He absolutely lived it all the time. He was just lived to astound and amuse himself. So you'd turn up at his house and he'd have his power and he'd built it. Chicken wire tubes that came out of everything and went to a summer house in the garden and another thing here, and he just sort of worked on creating this thing. And then you turn up another time and you go, yeah, I've taken to decorating the dog shit in the local area. No one picks up their dog shit, so I go out at night with balaclava and head torch, and I turn them into little sheep, or I like, put little dogs. That was for no one's amusement but his own.
But you sent him off to buy a computer,
yeah.
Instead of which
he got a parrot. Yeah,
that's Doris.
And that's Doris,
the cover
Doris
girl,
the parrot.
Who is still going strong in Hornsey.
Yes, that's right.
With her friend Groucho, and she's writing her autobiography as it happens.
Well, she Doris was a great artist. This one, I believe, is called The Bombing of Baghdad. They were highly political.
Are they Doris droppings?
These are a combination of Doris droppings and food and a bit of pecking as well here. I have got literally hundreds of these. And can I try and flog some? I've got literally hundreds of these of every scale and size. And my dad said to me, quite pointedly, not long before he died, never let any of these go for less than a grand. No, perhaps not. I think there's another thing that's important to remember about my dad, which was that, by his own admission, he was a recovering arsehole. And prone to frequent relapse. And I think, you know, I came across him one time. He was reading this book called Arsehole No More by Dr. Xavier Crement, Dr. X. Crement. And my heart leapt. I thought, this is fantastic. He's actually going to, you know, take seriously his arseholism and really try and take steps. And the next thing, all of his mates were receiving the whole arsehole trilogy. Saying, I think this might be for you. I think you need to read it. He hasn't learned it yet.
Richard, do you think there was a point where the British theatre could have changed if Ken had got his hands on the kind of on the jobs you were going to have, or do you think it was better? He stayed where.
Well, I'm sure the National Theatre would have been a lot of fun if Ken had run. But it wasn't in Ken's nature to want to run things, unless it was a venture, a caper. I mean, his life was made up of a succession of capers. And he had these incredible capers and enthusiasms, and as everyone said, he just caught you up in them. He tried to get me into Illuminatus. Was it Illuminatus in Liverpool?
Yeah.
Yeah. To play God. And he said,
no, it's a wonderful part, wonderful part. Peter Halls turned it down.
I couldn't go on stage because, I mean, Ken, I thought, was a fantastic actor. And Ken had a contempt for what he used to describe as tie acting. And tie acting is what most television acting is. You talk to your tie like that. And it's supposed to be very, very naturalistic. And Ken, he was in Law and Order playing a solicitor. And if you watch the performance, he actually plays it like that. I cast him once in a part that was perfectly suited. It was a Ben Johnson, and he decided he'd play it all in profile, like an Egyptian, like an Egyptian ideogram. So, and he never turned to the audience. He was just his contempt for actors who weren't giving it 1,000%. Was absolute. There was an actor, you say, act proper! By which he meant, you know, give it your all. You know, you're on stage and let everybody know about it.
But he would say, he'd say something like, yeah, do it all in profile and you'd be acting. Now I can see your other eye! Do it all with your chin out, man! Chin out! No further than that.
What are you doing?
John, as an actor and also as a performer, there is a, I don't know, with you, it's your acting and you're also being a performer. You did a lot of impressionism.
Yeah.
Ken was, as Richard said, I think a great actor, especially in Ben Jonson and in that he did with you, and also some of the other roles. But he said he gave up acting because he started to enjoy what the others were doing too much. So he was a great connoisseur of acting, and he could, you know. How does that work for you? Do you think because of working with Ken, you became a different kind of actor or a different kind of performer? And is there a distinction, do you think?
I don't really know the answer to that, Michael, but I will tell you that I got a phone call from Ken at his characteristic 2 o'clock in the morning. And this would have been, 10 years ago, maybe. I've been thinking about you, and I wonder what you're going to do, because you used to do these extraordinary improvisatory shows, and now you're just doing... I saw you in Miss Fucking Marple. I mean, you're all right as an actor, you know. You're not doing what you did before, you know.
So that, the answer to that was, I suppose I became more conventional as I got older. And I used to do those shows, if you remember, Michael, in black tights when I had the legs to show. Black tights and the white Shakespeare shirt, leap around all over the place. And Ken did give me the most astonishing amount of confidence. In fact, he put me through the Est. Does anyone remember Earhart seminar training? The thing about you, John, is you're not confident enough. You're whining about, oh, I can't do this, no, I can't do that. What you basically need is total confidence. So I'm enrolling you in the Earhart seminar training this weekend. So I did this bloody thing. And I had a breakdown 6 months later. Saying there about Ken giving up performing. I mean, Ken, as sure Daisy would have, you know, has almost probably the greatest face in showbiz. I mean, just, it's an alarming face. He's great eyebrows, bald head. He always used to be very sort of rosy. He was a lovely rosy complexion. And this extraordinary voice, you know, that he was a goblin. It's a goblin from another world. And yes, and you know, was it Ilford he came from? Was it Ilford? Yeah, but he never gave it sort of geezery cockneyisms. Although I think he liked acting with a lot of people who maybe people like Warren Mitchell as well. You know, like that.
But it's very interesting because he got to know Warren Mitchell after that. Everybody didn't love Opal play. And he showed him his play, which was Events of an Average Bath Night, which is one of the great titles, I think. Because he was being true to his lino. I remember he said to me that what he liked about you, that in theory you'd been true to your lino. In other words, that when he'd been in the toilet as a kid, he'd seen the characters in the lino and created a whole world from these people. And so Warren Mitchell sort of adopted him on this tour, and then the play flopped. And then whatever Ken wrote, he'd read. And then he'd sort of put him up as a babysitter. He'd go round and babysit, and he'd feed him. And Warren Mitchell read every single word Ken wrote, I think, from 1964 right through to whenever, and was in The Great Caper here in 1974. And he used to complain, in fact, that Ken was so popular with his children that when Warren Mitchell went home, they were rather disappointed that their own father had turned up. And where's Ken? And he got them... He was great with kids. And I think, Richard, you know how marvellous his kids' shows are. I mean, School for Clowns.
That's the best kids' show I've ever seen. Also, another brilliant performance from Ken as Professor Mole Reasons. And the show involved the kids. There were four pupils in the class, and the professor was Ken with a bald wig, plastic bald wig. And the professor gave them topics for their improvisation. And the whole thing, the audience was involved, and the class got out of control. And through the performance, which lasted about an hour, the Professor Mulreason's just managed to keep the class in order. And eventually the class went mutinied and drove out the professor. And Professor Mulreason's used to exit through the auditorium with the words, "I am unable to continue in the circumstances." And I thought he did this when I was at Nottingham, this wonderful, wonderful play. And he was walking out, and there were tears glistening. It was absolute method performance. And I saw him at my office. I could see the front of the theatre. I saw Ken coming out, having been expelled by these screaming children. And he was tottering round the corner, still in character. And I said, Ken, how did it go? "I was unable to continue."
So, Nina, you're off to Australia tomorrow. You've made a film with the...
I took the puppets, the bereaved puppets of Ken Campbell, to a resting place for puppets of dead ventriloquists in Kentucky in America, and donated one. But she had me replicated. Replicated, because I couldn't bear to leave her there. So I've done that, and we're going to Sydney Opera House. Indeed we are. And the film was completely to do with finding Ken's notes on ventriloquism and saying, "Nina, you've got to go to Kentucky, you've got to make a film, you've got to do it all yourself." So I did do that. And it's just amazing still to be doing his bidding now. And I'm always thinking, what was the next adventure, you know? It's so boring to think I'm not going to be told what they are. So I'm just sort of, you know, waiting. Don't look up there. Yeah.
Well, look...
Well, someone hit up. I'd like you to enter this gentleman here, Ken.
Proceeding down past the Royal Court when I saw a man entering a gentleman. Must have been Joe Orton.
Now, you're all here, we're up here. How about a question? Anyone want to join in and ask anything or say anything or bring up the house lights? Gosh, there you all are.
There's an answer to the plumbing problem at the Regent Picture House, which came up in the storytelling yesterday or the day before. I was up outside, up a ladder. Four huge guys walked under my ladder and then walked through the stage door, the place was chaos, and then came out. And I said, "What are you doing? Are you interested?" Turned out that they were four American Navy engineers on leave in Edinburgh. I said, "Look, you could go off and fuck lots of girls and get pissed, but I tell you, if you come in here and you can fix our plumbing, you will be absolutely hugely rewarded." I took them in, showed them pipes with no lavatory seats. They came back and spent 4 days totally fixed the plumbing and then vanished. Never saw them again. Didn't even come to see the show. That's a warp story.
That's Tim, isn't it? Tim Moran, thank you very much for that.
The warp had that effect, the synchronicities that would occur, I mean, with the warp revival, and I imagine the power was even stronger back in 78 or so, many people like to tell us. I remember there was one guy playing a character, and he was described as having these amazing green cowboy boots with gold moons and stars painted on them, and he was having trouble finding any cowboy boots in the local charity shops. And I said, "Well, go and see if the Albany's got anything in their store cupboard." And he went up there. There was literally nothing in there except a green pair of cowboy boots with moons and stars painted on them. It was stuff like that happened all the time. It was extraordinary, yeah. And it happened around him as well. He was a theatre man, but he was also had something of the mystic as well. There was something else.
He was a magician.
Yeah. Hi.
Can you tell them about the Welsh butter?
The Welsh butter. Yes, the Welsh. I'd gone on. My friends had all come to Wales with me. I'd gone on and on and on about this got to try the Welsh butter. The Welsh butter is better than any other butter. And it comes in this round pack. And Dad must get this Welsh butter. You'll get it, won't you? You'll get it. And we all went off to play and came back. And there indeed was the Welsh butter on a dish, beautifully round and everything. He said, go on, try it, put it on your toast, tell us if it's the best butter in the world. And I was saying, go on, everyone, eat it, it's the best, isn't it? It's so much better than English butter. He said, do you want to see the packet of the favourite butter in Wales? I found out what the favourite butter in Wales is, and he got out English butter packet that comes in a square thing. He got in quick. And stuck it on the plate. Just to humiliate me, the next morning I woke up and there was a card next to my bed that said, I'm so sorry for the humiliation of the Welsh butter. He must have brought back all that repressed rage about the scrambled yolk fiasco back when you were five. You know?
Well, you asked about Ilford, John. We have here tonight the leading lady of James Cooper's Renegade, with whom Ken first appeared in 1958. And in fact, not only that, we have a representative of the Ilford Recorder who accorded Ken most Best Supporting Actor 1959, which is his first theatrical award, where he played Alfieri in A View from the Bridge. And it always rather amuses me that Alfieri is someone who's sort of dealing with the audience, is halfway on, is in fact a sort of goader to the play. And so he was sort of getting into the groove at that stage. Yes. And I think where he grew up and where he came from and his mother dying young and growing up in that house with his dad was very formative, you know, for him. And one thing I really discovered from doing the book was that thanks to Daisy and Prue, I could see all his files and all his scripts, that he was the most incredible exact writer. You know, I think they say that Mozart never changed a note in his scores. If you look at Ken's scripts, there's not a spelling error, and there's hardly a typo, and it's perfect punctuation. And he was writing like that from a very young age. And there were stories that he sent off to unlikely magazines. He got a rejection from Nova, the new magazine for the modern woman. but he was published by Talk and Town and all Radio Times, all sorts of strange, unexpected places, while he was writing these plays about landladies and people in Ilford, where he grew up. And so he was, I think, primarily, in the first place, a writer.
Did he write longhand or did he type?
He typed, because his dad was a cable operator, so the house was full of typewriters. And so from a very young age, he was typing away.
And I remember once I broke his Q key on one of his typewriters, and he said, oh, no, I'm going to write plays without the letter Q in it.
That's like the George Perec novel without the letter E, which formed the basis of one of his improvisations. Is Sean here?
Hello, Michael.
Can you remind us of the E-less Ken Campbell performance?
Yeah. You were mentioning earlier that things would happen around Ken. When he was first interested in lithography, we all have to learn huge chunks of Georges Perec's La Disparition, pre-based French novel, without using the letter E. But Ken was particularly keen that Gilbert Adair, in 1984, I believe, and translated it into English. The English didn't have a letter E. And we used to go up, in fact, we start again on Monday for the next 4 weeks. Later, we're up at East 15 doing the bit. We do an annual Ken project. And in 2007, started in 2007. In 2009, we had a whole bunch of East 15 students. We were up to the Lakeside in Colchester. One of them had learned Gilbert Adair's Blackbird, which is Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven. Except for that letter E, so the Raven says not again. And she'd written her own A-less version called Crow. She learned all three and she could switch syllable to syllable between all three versions. So we were looking forward to show her off at the Colchester Lakeside. We got in and we were in the green room and I said, right, come on, we're going to make Ken proud. And I saw on the door there was a poster and it was Gilbert Adair speaks. I said, hey, look, Gilbert Adair's here this month. What day is it? Oh, it's today. Well, what time is he on? He's on now. And next door to the dressing room was the Waterstones, and there was Gilbert Adair and about three members of the public sitting there, and his entire drama department crowded and said, "Mr. Adair, Mr. Adair, oh, we love your book, can we do it now for you?" He said, "Oh, yes, he's written to me a lot."
Amazing that was in Colchester, because Ken's first job in Rep was at the Colchester Rep. In fact, he used to think of himself or describe himself once as the Peter Brook of the Colchester Rep. where he perfected the art of playing the third act inspector. He revolutionised this by actually learning the lines, because in tradition you just read the lines off a notebook. Not only did he learn the lines, he then learnt that he had to start looking for clues. So the third act inspector must have been a riot in Colchester. Look, we've got a few minutes left. I'd just like to say thank you for everyone for coming and for all our distinguished guests. Is there anything you have to add, Granny? Final word? Have you said something yet?
Oh, Nina, help me. Hangs up, Hank. No, just to say that I loved him very much. And I miss him very much. And that's not funny, so what shall I say now? We're off to the Sydney Opera House, thanks to Ken, to do our show, so that's very exciting. That's not funny either, you're showing off.
Remember once David Rappaport, sadly no longer with us. And Ken introduced, David was a small person, a very small person. And Ken introduces, "Ladies and gentlemen, may I present Mr. David Rappaport. He's not the shortest actor in the world. He's fucking close."
He played the midget, I think, didn't he?
Yeah. And he went off to do, he was poached after Illuminatus by Peter Hall to be in Volpone. And Ken was going, "I'm going to do a load of Volpone."
Wasn't he slightly disappointed when you all went off to do respectable work in the
theatre? He kept coming back from time to time. I mean, I suppose there was. Finally, a moment when you think, "Oh, I can't bring myself to it." But I went back and did the pig play at New End, and as you referred to earlier, which was, and there were two live pigs, which we, Mike Hurst, who hasn't been mentioned enough at all, but he's a huge figure in Ken's life, and so he had Mike's performing pigs, which he kept in the car park at the Roundhouse. Every day,
those were the ones I performed.
Probably, yeah,
they weren't.
And we took them from every day from the Roundhouse car park in his blue van down to the theatre at New End and put them on stage. And I was, because I'm more responsible than some, I was given the job of pig wrangler. So my whole life was taken over by feeding and moving and clearing out these pigs with a short duration. That was a wonderful science fiction play.
We don't remember the author of that play. It was a defrocked Liverpool priest, wasn't he, who read it?
Yeah.
Do you remember his name? I never traced that.
Alan something.
What were the names of the writers of the Illuminatus again?
Robert Shea and Robert Anton Wilson.
Robert Anton Wilson. Ken would always say he'd come up with a name of somebody you'd never heard of, who'd written a book that you'd probably find remained in somewhere. It's a J. Trevor Landesman. Colour of green according to the number 16. Marvellous book. Brilliant.
Yeah, he said, it's not that I'm not mad, I just read different books.
That's right. And,
look, thanks to Sean bringing us full circle with the School of Night, which I think does go right back to Theatre Machine, which was born in this very theatre in 1962 with Keith Johnston and Bill Gaskell. And so there is a real continuum, I think, between this theatre with Ken Campbell, despite all the diversions and divagations that have gone on in his incredible life. I don't know. If the book's no good, there's going to be a thunderbolt with my name on it coming right out. But thanks to you, I hope it's okay. And it's been great fun. It's been a labour of love, I can't tell you. And I'm so pleased with it. And thank you all for coming. And thank you, Richard, John, Jim, Nina, and Daisy, and Granny, for coming and sharing.